From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Kids 12 to 15 may be able to get a COVID vaccine shot as soon as tomorrow. U.S. regulators authorized the two-dose shot for 12 to 15-year-olds earlier this week. And today, a CDC advisory committee is reviewing clinical trial data. This is the last step before the U.S. gives states the official thumbs up to open up vaccinations for this age group. And President Biden met yesterday with five bipartisan governors to hammer out ways to get more people vaccinated. And one of those governors at the meeting was Spencer Cox, Republican governor of Utah. And Governor Cox joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Tanya. I'm excited to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you. Well, first, President Biden has praised you for your vaccine rollout in Utah. But right now, we're seeing that only about 40% of the population there has received one dose. What are some of the challenges you're facing?
Well, sure. I want to point out that those statistics are a little off for good reason. We're the youngest state in the nation, and because kids aren't able to get the vaccine, that makes it a bigger struggle for us. But we're doing very well with our adult population. But there are challenges, and every governor is facing those challenges right now. And those challenges are we're not really to the vaccine hesitant yet, as I said with President Biden. We've gotten through what I call the vaccine ecstatic or the vaccine excited. And now we're moving into the vaccine busy and the vaccine curious. And so we have to make it as easy as possible for those people, especially younger people, to get the vaccine. And we're doing that by becoming more mobile, putting the vaccine into places where people are. So we're going to work sites and churches, nonprofit organizations, everywhere we can get a vaccine, a mobile vaccine clinic. We're taking it right to the people.
I want to break down some of those strategies. As you mentioned, you have one of the youngest populations in the country. What is your strategy specifically for kids to get more kids vaccinated, especially now that the FDA has authorized Pfizer's COVID-19 use for kids 12 to 15?
Right. That's a big deal, again, especially for Utah, because we do have more kids per capita than anywhere else in the country. And so getting that approval this week will make a big difference in our numbers. And so specifically with kids, we're working with pediatricians, having them contact parents and kids that they provide services to, and working with schools as well to get as many kids the opportunity to get vaccinated as possible.
On the call, President Biden said you made a good point about people needing to see a model of what a vaccinated person can do. How would you describe your approach to managing COVID-19 restrictions specifically in your state?
Sure. And unfortunately, what we're seeing, and this is what I challenged the president on, and we're seeing it from the White House in particular, but many who are fully vaccinated and not even following the CDC recommendations, which we believe are still too restrictive, but they're still wearing masks outside when they're not around other people. They're still wearing masks when they're around fully vaccinated people. And that provides a disincentive for people to get vaccinated. We should be modeling as I keep saying, and as I said yesterday, if you're fully vaccinated, we should start acting like it. And what we know with this vaccine, with these vaccines, are that they are incredibly effective. And so showing people that you can get back to normal when you're fully vaccinated is a great incentive to get people vaccinated. And I was excited to hear that the president agreed with me and that we would be seeing more of that.
One of the big challenges you're still facing, even with some of the ways that you are handling distribution, with having mobile options for folks, there's still vaccine hesitancy in your state. There has been a decline in vaccine demand there, as in other states. Governor, have you had any tough personal conversations with friends or family members or even community members about the vaccine? And how did you handle those?
Sure. Well, we just give people the best information we can. I have not a family member of mine, but a family member of a close friend who didn't believe in it, didn't believe in the vaccine, refused to get it, and unfortunately is in the hospital in very serious condition right now. And it's heartbreaking to know that was completely preventable. And so those are the tough conversations that we continue to have. Unfortunately, it's some who are the most vocal about getting back to normal who are are also the most vocal in opposition to the vaccine. And so we're presenting, again, just good information. That's all we can do is give people the very best data. And we're seeing that is making a difference. With those who are open to it but still unsure, one conversation with their doctor can change everything.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I want to talk about the current state of the Republican Party. There's the vote that passed today to oust Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming from her House leadership position after she criticized former President Trump's lies about the election. Are you disappointed by today's vote? I know that you have said that the Republican Party has to allow for differences when asked about the push to oust Representative Liz Cheney.
Yeah, I'm saddened by what happened today. It saddens me when I see this type of divide happening in my party, the party I've been a member of my entire life. And I certainly hope that we can heal some of those divides and bring people back together.
That's Utah Governor Spencer Cox. Governor, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
And now to West Virginia, where the country's biggest drug distributors, AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal Health, and McKesson, are on trial for their role in the deadly opioid crisis in that state. There have been a number of lawsuits across the country that have ended in settlements, but this is the first federal trial to hold drug distributors accountable for the public health emergency. Joining us now is Eric Ayer. He's an investigative reporter for the Mountain State Spotlight. He's been covering the trial and the issue in West Virginia. Eric, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
So the city of Huntington and the county where it's located say these companies created a public nuisance by dumping opioids into their communities. What's the argument they're trying to make?
Well, they flooded the communities with opioids. I mean, we have families torn apart, a foster care system in shambles, grandparents raising their grandchildren, higher jail costs, higher hospital costs, even things like the morgue are backed up. We had the highest drug overdose death we've had last year that we've ever had in the history of the state.
Well, and we know a lot of this because of your reporting, which revealed that between 2007 and 2012, there were more than 1,700 overdose deaths in West Virginia. Drug wholesalers flooded the state with 780 million hydrocodone and oxycodone pills. That works out to be 433 pills for every person, which is far above the national average. Do we know why that happened?
Yeah. Well, the drug distributors would tell you that that's because there's so many prescriptions that have been written for opioids. They also would tell you that the Drug Enforcement Administration would turn a blind eye to these massive shipments. And, you know, frankly, they made a lot of money. They made billions and billions of dollars by flooding these small communities with prescription opioids like hydrocodone and oxycodone. And they didn't necessarily target Appalachia, but they certainly, when they knew that they knew what the sales were doing, they turned on the spigot.
So this federal trial is now in its second week. Can you recap what's happened so far and who's taken the stand and what we've heard?
Yeah, I just got back. I was just there this morning. They've had the current fire chief of Huntington, Jan Rader. She talked about the toll that this has taken on the EMS people and your firefighters and how they're so stressed out. They have to respond to so many opioid overdoses. And the last thing they've been doing is they've had an expert witness on the stand, the plaintiffs being the city of Huntington and Campbell County, that had an expert witness, and he's going through pharmacy by pharmacy and disclosing that, you know, millions and millions of pills were shipped to pharmacies, not only just in the city of Huntington and Campbell County, but in surrounding counties as well.
What's the defense argument, the lawyers for these companies, what are they saying about why they shouldn't be held responsible for the crisis in West Virginia?
Well, they say, Peter, they say, hey, you know, don't look at us. We're just the middlemen. We're in the quote-unquote logistics business. Something new that's happened is they're starting to put a lot of blame on manufacturers like Purdue Pharma for sparking the opioid crisis and for pressuring doctors and hospitals to treat pain with OxyContin. In the opening arguments, the lawyers for the defendants, the drug distributors, they mentioned Purdue 18 times, so that's clearly going to be part of their strategy.
You've been reporting the story for a long time. You wrote a book about it. You won a Pulitzer Prize for it. What's at stake in your mind for this trial? I mean, the opioid crisis has affected, as you say, millions of people in your state and across the country.
Yeah, I mean, what's at stake is we need resources here. You know, we have over 150,000 people with substance use disorder, many or most of them with opioid use disorder. It's such an issue. There's not anybody here that doesn't know somebody that's been affected by the opioid crisis.
Eric Ayer, investigative reporter for the Mountain State Spotlight in West Virginia. Thank you very much for your reporting.
Well, thanks for having me on.
A conservative wish list of legislation is advancing in two bellwether states, Texas and Florida, including restrictions on voting. Let's get right to it with two people who watch this close. Anna Ceballos, who covers politics for the Miami Herald. She joins us on Skype. Hi, Anna.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And Patrick Svitek, who covers politics for the Texas Tribune. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So all of the levers of power in Florida and Texas are controlled by Republicans, and both states are seeing a population boom. Are changing demographics empowering Republicans, or are they worrying them? Patrick, let's start with you.
Well, I think for a number of years now, changing demographics in Texas have continued to shift the political landscape at the state level, away from Republicans. We can debate how fast that environment has been moving away from them and how fast it's been moving in favor of Democrats. But there's no doubt that Texas has been experiencing a political transformation as the state has gotten more diverse and has just grown in general. And so you can see that that is fueling some anxiety over their electoral prospects. They did just beat back kind of an all-out Democratic offensive in the 2020 election, but they did come out of that election, echoing a lot of the concerns and some of the unfounded, theories that you saw at the national level from former President Trump about the integrity of that election.
And Anna, you're seeing something similar in Florida.
Yes. So in Florida, what you have to keep in mind is we're known as this purple state for a reason. Within the Hispanic community, there are different voting blocks. There's people who fled Cuba, people who fled Venezuela, who are afraid of the word socialism, so that turned them off for some of the messaging that Republicans were targeting against Democrats. And not all Hispanics will vote the same way. So within that group, for example, we saw it in Miami-Dade County. There were, compared to 2016, there were more people who voted for Trump. The county is the most populous, and it was still blue. But that swing mattered in this purple state that is decided by razor thin margins. And this was the thing that lawmakers started mentioning and talking about ahead of the legislative session. They were saying, we have this mandate. There was a shift to the right in the state.
Anna, what I'm hearing from you is that Trumpism is really driving the agenda in your state.
He does have a pretty big base of supporters here. And you can see that through our governor. He became governor after being endorsed by Trump. He was a very little known congressman back then. And his national appeal has just skyrocketed over the past 3 years since he came into office.
Let's get into some of the legislation around voting restrictions. Just yesterday, Arizona's governor signed a measure that would make it harder to get a mail-in ballot. Both Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Texas Secretary of State Ruth Hughes have said that last year's elections were fair and secure. Yet on Fox News last week, Governor DeSantis signed this bill that would make it harder to get an absentee ballot and find an available ballot box. Let's listen.
Me signing this bill here says, Florida, your vote counts. Your vote is going to be cast with integrity and transparency, and this is a great place for
democracy. Real quick question. Governor, real quick question. Will you allow...
And we know that a similar bill is advancing in Texas. What's the fight like over these bills? Are lawmakers being held accountable for these laws when we know no fraud took place? Let's start with you, Patrick.
Right. So a lot of what you're seeing happen in the Texas legislature right now is kind of a reaction in some ways to what Harris County in Texas tried to institute in the lead up to the November election. Harris County is a county of, you know, over 2 million registered voters. It's home to Houston. It's by far the biggest county in Texas. And ahead of the November election, Harris County successfully and unsuccessfully in some cases tried to institute a number of election reforms. One of them that they unsuccessfully tried to institute but probably drew the most controversy was sending out unsolicited applications for mail-in ballots to all their registered voters. And that, you know, was ultimately stymied in the courts. But one of the big provisions as part of the legislation working its way through the process in Austin right now is a blanket ban on counties sending out unsolicited mail-in ballot applications. So they're really taking aim at that as well. There are a number of other provisions that could make it into the final version of this bill. There's been some, even among Texas Republicans, there's been some difference of opinion in how far to go.
How strong is that pushback in the legislature?
There aren't exactly, you know, Texas Republican lawmakers, you know, openly criticizing other Texas Republican lawmakers for going too far. But you can see in the different versions of the bills that have gone through the Senate and the House that they are not unified on what exactly should ultimately be included in the bill that makes it to Governor Abbott's desk. There wasn't a Senate provision that got stripped out in the House that required, you know, our large counties to redistribute polling places under a formula that concerns a lot of voting rights advocates, could move polling locations away from areas with more Hispanic and Black residents. So that was clearly a more controversial provision that didn't make it from the Senate version of the bill into the House version of the bill.
Anna, what about in Florida? We've seen that there have been many vocal activist groups that have been speaking out against this, but what has it been like at the state capitol?
So in the state capitol, you know, the elections bill was among the most contentious measures considered during the legislative session. There was also some pushback from all of the Florida 67 election supervisors. They said that the call for these election reforms were unnecessary considering the state's success in the 2020 election. But it was interesting to see, you know, our northern neighbor in Georgia lawmakers faced a lot of backlash from corporations and Major League Baseball when they passed their election bills. And right in the immediate aftermath, Florida Republicans did water down their own bill during session, and they abandoned proposals that would have banned the use of drop boxes and to impose strict signature matching requirements. So there was some outside pressure, if you will, more so than on the debate floor.
Let's talk a little bit more about the impacts here. So last week, Texas State Representative Rafael Anchia asked Election Committee Chair Briscoe Cain why Cain used some language that harkens back to the Jim Crow era in drafting the voting bill. Let's listen.
And you talked about preserving the purity of the ballot box. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a quotation from the Texas Constitution. It'd be Article 6, Section 4.
Right. And are you aware of the history behind that provision of the Constitution?
I'm not.
Okay, we know that Texas has a long history of discriminating against Black voters using measures like poll taxes. This purity phrase was eventually dropped from this bill that lawmakers are debating. But was this a wake-up moment for anyone in the state, Patrick?
You know, I don't think it was in terms of changing minds in the Texas House or in the Texas Senate. It was obviously a kind of embarrassing moment for Briscoe Cain, the House Elections Chair, who's carrying this bill in the lower chamber. But by and large, you're seeing, you know, each side retreat to their corners on this, and it's been a very partisan issue.
Patrick, there are so many other bills up before legislators. The session, as you said, it isn't over yet. What else will you be watching for in the coming days?
Yeah, this session in Texas has been pretty fascinating. It started out very low key with, we had the election of a new House Speaker. We were consumed with questions about how big our budget shortfall was going to be. We were consumed with questions about how much, you know, practically speaking, how lawmakers could gather amid the pandemic. And a lot of those kind of more bread and butter kind of, you know, sober issues have kind of given away to what's become a red meat session here at the end. In addition to the advancement of these election bills, you're also seeing the advancement of permitless carry of handguns, which has been a longtime priority of gun rights activists here in Texas. And so you're seeing the advancement at the end here of some red meat issues that I think a lot of people at the beginning of our session didn't expect there to be a lot of space in the conversation for, but they are, you know, advancing pretty briskly. The State House, this is a critical week for the State House. There are a number of bill killing deadlines that have come up, and they spent this week 4 to 6 hours debating a bill that aims to ban the teaching, the required teaching at least, of critical race theory in Texas classrooms. And so you're really seeing the legislature at the end here kind of tack to the right in a way that I don't think a lot of people expected going into this legislative session in Texas.
Anna, what are you watching for next in Florida politics?
So our legislative session ended a week ago. I was, along with a lot of lawmakers, were surprised at how culture wars became such a focus of this legislative session and how big of a winner DeSantis ended up being of pretty much every single thing he requested. He got the transgender athlete ban with the anti-riot bill. They were more emboldened to pass some of these conservative bills, and it will be interesting to see what happens next year and whether they keep building on that or if this was the grand finale, and then they're just going to make some tweaks to their priorities. I guess we'll see.
A lot to watch for. Ana Ceballos covers politics for the Miami Herald, and Patrick Svitek covers politics for the Texas Tribune. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
Some Goodwill stores are facing an unexpected challenge: fast-growing trash bills. It's the result of items they can't sell and broken and recyclable materials and items ending up in donation bins. In this story that first aired on All Things Considered, Todd Bookman of New Hampshire Public Radio reports on what may be behind the costly trend.
I'll set the scene. I'm outside the Goodwill location in Seabrook, New Hampshire. It's a bright, sunny day, and they are about to open up for donations.
We hope everyone brings great things that help our programs, but we know some people make some questionable judgments about what is good to donate, and so we're talking about the literal trash we sometimes see slip through in the donation stream.
This is Heather Steves, spokesperson for the Goodwill locations in Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire. Steves is armed with trash examples, items they received just the day before.
A lampshade, which is stained and disgusting and literally falling apart.
A small table missing a leg, cracked Tupperware, a used sponge.
Dental medical tool?
I can't believe you're touching
it. I can't believe I'm touching it either. It's really, really, truly disgusting.
Goodwill does recycle lots of what it can't sell. It reuses textiles and refurbishes some broken electronics. But last year, just the 30 locations in Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire combined to throw away more than 13 million pounds of waste. Technically, other people's garbage.
All this trash adds up to more than $1 million a year in a trash bill, and it's been growing every year for the past 5 years.
So what is going on here? To some extent, it's a phenomenon called wish cycling,
where people are hoping that something is recyclable, and therefore they put it in with their recycling.
This is Reagan Bissonnette with the Northeast Resource Recovery Association, a recycling group. We've been trained not to throw anything away, but not necessarily how to get rid of it properly. And a lot of what we buy, we don't even need in the first place. Cindy Eisenhower is a professor in the Climate Change Institute at the University of Maine. She researches the reuse economy, from yard sales to thrift shops to Goodwills.
They are absolutely inundated with stuff.
The challenge is these sellers rely on people dropping off their items.
And of course, nobody wants to discourage the donations. So I think everybody feels that they're walking a very fine line here.
And so Goodwill is doing this, a bit of a media tour, asking people to be more careful. Heather Steves says their timing here is strategic.
Spring cleaning is always very busy. The only busier time we have is when Marie Kondo comes out with a new TV show.
Spring cleaning, yes.
Ron Davitt is dropping off a trunk full of items.
All's in pretty good shape. Actually, as I look at this, there's no drawer. I'll probably keep that and throw it away.
He's got clothes in good condition, some housewares, and some items from the back of the closet.
A dog.
Oh, dog costumes?
Yeah.
Oh,
very small dog costumes.
This is for our dachshund who's in the car, hot dog.
See, this is not trash.
That dog costume will go within 1 minute of being on the sales floor.
Steve says the key question to ask before dropping something off is, if you needed it, would you buy it in this condition? Or another way to think about it.
You know, we've seen comments on our Facebook page recently that are like, if you wouldn't give it to your judgmental mother-in-law, don't donate it.
Your mother-in-law? She'd love that dog costume. For NPR News, I'm Todd Bookman.
Critics of President Biden's decision to pull all American troops out of Afghanistan say the U.S. withdrawal will only embolden the Taliban, and that's exactly what seems to be happening now. The Taliban say they have captured a strategic district near the capital, Kabul. They also claim to have captured a large cache of weapons from Afghan security forces. All of this is going on, of course, as Afghanistan is still reeling from the attack on a girls' school in Kabul last Saturday that left more than 60 people dead, many of them children. The government blamed the Taliban, but the group denies involvement. The BBC's Sikandar Kermani is following all of this. He's in Islamabad in Pakistan. He's on a Skype line. Sikandar, first of all, tell us about what happened in this district near Kabul. The fighting was reportedly quite intense.
Yeah, so this is Nurk district in Wardak province. It's to the south of Kabul. It's an area that has seen a lot of fighting in the past. But last night, the Taliban say they took control of the whole district. That meant overrunning an army base. Now, the Afghan government has said that their forces made a tactical retreat. They say they're going to send reinforcements, they'll take it back. You know, maybe that will happen in the future, but certainly this is a worrying sign for them, especially given that it's happened relatively close to Kabul, along a kind of close to a key highway going from Kabul down to the south of the country. And this is very much part of an increase in Taliban assaults that we've seen on Afghan government positions over the last 2 weeks. They've been taking more and more territory and pressing closer to major cities.
The fact that it is only 25 miles from the capital, Kabul, does the Taliban appear to have their sights on taking that city?
Look, I think at the moment what we're seeing from the Taliban is them certainly upping the ante, but they haven't made huge incursions inside major Afghan cities yet. We're also heading to this three-day ceasefire for the Muslim Festival of Eid. That should start tomorrow. But the Taliban have said that that won't be extended, that that will just be a three-day ceasefire. American and Afghan officials are saying, look, what's really important, more than these brief pauses in the fighting, is that the negotiations between the Afghan government side and the Taliban resume.
Is your sense that the Afghan security forces, the Afghan army, are just outmatched? I mean, do they have any chance of pushing the Taliban back?
Well, look, the momentum is certainly with the Taliban. I think we can see that over recent years, the Taliban have been growing in a stronger and stronger position, even with international troops. So the main role of international troops has either been in a kind of advisory position, or really, when in terms of combat, it's been in airstrikes. And those airstrikes certainly have been key in keeping the Taliban advance back. But the Afghan government, its public position is, we've been leading the fight for the last 6-7 years. We are well equipped to do it. I think in private, there are a lot of concerns about how they will cope.
So, I mean, it seems clear, right, that the Taliban are trying to step in and regain control of Afghanistan as American and NATO forces start to leave or consider this pullout. From your view there in Pakistan, how is the region bracing for the weeks and the months ahead?
The real concern I think that everyone has is that could the Afghan government side disintegrate into various different factions? So we have a total civil war scenario. That's what happened, you know, after the Soviet withdrawal in 1989. And lots of people are making those kind of comparisons between the exit of one superpower, the USSR back then, and the exit of another superpower, America. Now, that's the thing that's on a lot of people's minds in Afghanistan. My sense from the Taliban, I spent some time with them as well in Afghanistan recently, is that they would certainly prefer to come to power through a negotiated settlement rather than by pure military force. But at the same time, they want peace and that settlement to be completely on their own terms. At the moment, they don't seem to be showing any signs of compromising. They want to create what they term an Islamic government.
The BBC's Sukhinder Karmani speaking with us from Islamabad, Pakistan. Sukhinder, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, in the 1950s and 60s, neighborhoods of color in the United States were often destroyed to make way for new development. And typically, people would be paid little to nothing for the property they lost. But now in Athens, Georgia, former residents of a neighborhood erased by so-called urban renewal have won compensation of a sort. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Grant Blankenship has more.
On a weekday afternoon, students flow down Baxter Street in Athens from high-rise dormitories at the University of Georgia campus.
She was like, yeah, Laurel, they're cute.
That's where I meet Hattie Thomas Whitehead. When she was young, she lived here too.
When I was a little girl, this was a dirt. It was not paved.
That was the 1950s, when this was a neighborhood called Linentown. Hattie was born and raised here.
Fourth generation. It was seven children, seven of us, and my mom and dad lived in a shotgun house on this side of the street.
Hattie points toward Creswell Hall, one of three 10-story dormitories where today college students live. But when she was young, this was home to brick masons, janitors, nurses.
All working people, but hardworking people for meager wages, $8 to $10 a week.
It was also a majority black neighborhood. That was until the early 60s. Around the same time the University of Georgia lost a court battle to remain segregated, the city of Athens and the school decided they wanted Linentown for those high-rise dorms. So they labeled Linentown a, quote, slum. And the city used eminent domain to acquire houses in this neighborhood where Hattie says more than half the families were homeowners. When residents were paid for their loss, records suggest they only got about a third of market value. And to send a message to those still living in the neighborhood that it was time to move, Hattie says the empty homes would often be demolished by bulldozers in the dead of night.
Or they had the Athens Clark County Fire Department to burn them down, of people that we knew, of homes that we knew.
All of which was terrifying. Hattie's father saved for years before building their house.
My family never become homeowners again.
Geneva Johnson was also a Linentown resident. Today she lives in a home that was actually trucked from the old neighborhood to what is today Athens Clark County Commission member Mariah Parker's district. When Johnson told Parker her story a few years ago, Parker says she heard a woman still very much in trauma.
You could hear it in Miss Johnson's voice, where her voice would shake when she would talk about this thing that happened, you know, 50, 60 years ago, but it was so, so impactful for her family.
Since that conversation, former Linentown residents have worked with the County Commission's Justice and Memory Project, which is aimed at undoing some of the damage of the urban renewal period. And from that came a proposed resolution, acknowledging not only the economic damage done to Linentown, but putting a name to the tactics used to force residents out. The names? Terrorism and white supremacy, which posed a problem for Commissioner Russell Edwards.
If we pass this document, we will be alleging that the university system of Georgia, the University of Georgia, has committed an act of white supremacist terrorism.
And that, Edwards feared, would hold up progress. So he wanted to soften the language, hammer out a compromise with UGA just to make something good happen. Meanwhile, Commissioner Mariah Parker says the school seemed most interested in avoiding any blame at all.
They have refuted the claim that Linentown was a black community and refuted the any claims of wrongdoing to us in an email, I think, shortly after discussions began publicly.
But Linentown residents wouldn't budge on the resolution's language. They wanted the fear and trauma they lived through to be recognized. And as Russell Edwards reflected on the stories he'd heard from Hattie Thomas Whitehead and others.
Being up at night in her bed and hearing the destruction of houses adjacent to hers, you know, coming home from school one day, seeing that the fire department was burning down one of the houses, you know, thinking back to the numbers and the amount of money that was paid to the residents for them to move.
Edwards ultimately found the Linnentown history indefensible.
This was a terrorist act.
Neither the University of Georgia nor the Board of Regents have yet to comment publicly on the Linnentown resolution, but it unanimously passed the Athens-Clarke County Commission. And as a result, terrorism and white supremacy in Linnentown became a matter of public record. A state law won't allow Linnentown residents or their descendants to receive real cash reparations.
Economic development, telecommunications.
So instead, they'll pursue something called participatory budgeting. A yet-to-be-determined chunk of county funds will be spent where and how the residents deem best. Hattie Thomas Whitehead has some ideas.
One was affordable housing. Affordable housing in Athens.
And so that no one will forget what happened to the old neighborhood, Linnentown will have a historic marker placed near those high-rise University of Georgia dormitories. The school's Board of Regents hasn't said if they'll allow the marker on their property, but the county has enough right-of-way on surrounding streets that the university may not have a say in where it goes. For Here and Now, I'm Grant Blankenship in Athens, Georgia.
In California, a program meant to reduce carbon emissions may actually be making the problem worse, according to a new study by the nonprofit Carbon Plan. California's program allows fossil fuel companies and other polluters to buy carbon credits. In other words, they pay forest owners to maintain the land so that the trees soak up more carbon and then offset the company's emissions. But the study found a major accounting error. Lisa Song is a climate reporter for ProPublica. She looked into the study with MIT Technology Review. Lisa, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. So we tried our best there to describe how California's offset program works, but in your own telling of it, what was it designed to do?
So the program was designed to get landowners in California to manage their forests in a way where they're reducing the amount of logging they would do or doing other kinds of activities to increase how quickly their forests are growing. And the whole point of it is to prevent additional CO2 emissions from coming from the forest and to absorb more CO2 from the air over time.
The program is built on pretty basic math. One carbon credit is equal to one ton of carbon saved. But as you point out in this article, not all forests are equal. Some trees are actually much better at storing carbon. Why is that?
It all depends on the type of tree that you have. So if you have a tree species like these larger Douglas firs or redwoods that you'll see on the coast of California, those trees can store a lot more carbon in their trunks and branches when compared to some of the other tree species that are just smaller and shorter. So it makes a big difference what type of forest you're looking at in terms of how much carbon can be stored in that forest.
So how does that difference then lead to an accounting problem in California's carbon offset program that you've described? What's going on there?
So if you're a landowner and you want to put your forest in the carbon offset program, one of the steps you would take is hire these consultants to come and survey your forest. And then they calculate how many tons of carbon can be stored in your forest for every acre. And then what you would do is compare that number against the amount of carbon stored on a typical forest in your area. And these typical forest numbers are numbers calculated by the California regulators, and those numbers are called regional averages. The problem is that the way these regional averages are calculated, they're calculated from a huge mix of very different types of trees and across very large geographic regions, that it opens the door for projects to get more credits than they deserve.
So how is that making the problem worse so that more emissions are actually going into the atmosphere than before?
So whenever a polluter buys a carbon credit, they are getting the right to emit one more ton of CO2. And that ton of CO2 emissions is real, whether or not the carbon credit they've purchased is truly good for the climate. So that means that all of these ghost credits out there are credits that are being sold and purchased and used, but they're not actually helping the climate.
And the polluters that buy these credits that don't help the environment, you call them ghost credits, by the way, do they actually know what they're doing, that the math is flawed and that they might actually be putting out more carbon than they think?
Well, the companies that buy these credits are just operating within the system. And that's one of the main findings of the study, is that nobody is breaking the rules. The rules are flawed. And until the rules themselves are fixed, the system can continue creating these ghost credits that don't actually help the climate.
The end result is that forests are still being protected. Isn't that enough? I mean, that's still on the surface a good thing, and it satisfies the point of these types of programs, right?
Right. In terms of conservation, that's certainly a good thing. What the study authors point out is the offset program has created up to 39 million tons of carbon that aren't actually helping the environment. That is equal to the annual emissions of 8.5 million cars.
California's model is now under consideration in other states, like Oregon, for example. And even the Biden administration wants to use carbon storage and forests to be part of its path to cutting emissions by the end of the decade. So what's the lesson here? As more and more government agencies are trying to look into this and do it, do these projects work? Should we be doing them?
I think the lesson is to look carefully at the rules and try and assess, are the rules working the way they're supposed to? Are they actually delivering the amount of carbon benefit promised?
Lisa Song is a climate reporter for ProPublica. We're going to link you to her story so you can dig into it for yourself if you're interested. Lisa, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Hear It Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.